Very often, mining companies, they tell you they've rehabilitated a site, or they may even pretend they've restored it. And what they've actually done is they've built a golf course, or they've planted a lot of conifers that don't actually belong in that place at all, and that do very little for the biodiversity of the place. And where they've cut off the top of a mountain, well, no, we can't restore that. There are levels of damage that are not restorable, certainly not within a human timescale. But those are relatively extreme examples. I mean, one of the examples that I find kind of encouraging is that with Irish peat bogs, which are drained and then the peat is extracted for fuel, you might think that, you know, the production of peat is something that takes centuries. But we have established in Ireland, with great difficulty, that it is possible to restore the peat-forming processes. And peat actually does begin to form again quite quickly, simply in some cases by blocking the drains and re-wetting the bog. So I think that most systems can be restored to a greater or lesser degree. But yes, when we begin cutting up the topography, we can't restore it. And in fact, as I say, in Alcoa's operation in Australia, there is one thing they have changed that they cannot restore, and that is that the whole system is 4 meters lower than the old system. So, yeah, we should be very careful about cutting the tops off mountains, that's for sure. Thank you. It's something that I've been thinking about agriculture more and more and more over the last year, and the degree to which there can be a coexistence between agriculture, which is obviously not restoration, but that farms can incorporate elements of restoration, and how we can engage with farmers to make it attractive for them to do it, should they not find it attractive, and actually quite often they do. In terms of recuperating land for agriculture that has been urbanized, it's certainly not impossible. And it is being done. And what you're seeing also is a lot of urban agriculture. I mean, you're much more familiar with this, I'm sure, than I am in Detroit, for example, in Cuba, where in the worst years after the fall of the Soviet Union with the U.S. blockade still in place, they built these organoponicos in Cuban cities where they developed incredible vegetable production on raised beds. But I don't think these things are restoration as such. There's something else. There's something that's necessary and good, but I think they're kind of in a different category. But so I've been more interested in looking at the degree to which quite small changes on an industrial scale farm can actually restore at least a degree of the biodiversity within the farm. There's quite a few questions, so I'm going to keep this gentleman here.
Did Alcoa have a game plan in place before they turned the first blade of soil, or was it an afterthought in the rest?
No. The story of that, I mean, I could almost talk, and I can't talk for half an hour about, and I don't claim to fully understand the reasons that Alcoa took this decision at this particular plant. But long story short, no, they started off doing really crude rehabilitation, planting conifers, essentially, in completely inappropriate places. And then I think it had a lot to do with the vision of a particular chief executive, but there was a business motivation, which was, this is one of the most valuable bauxite sites in the world. They want to have the license as long as there's bauxite there. And so I think he told his bosses, it is worth investing 1% of our profit in this. To actually, like, the bar for restoration in Australia is getting higher all the time. So they said, but what if the bar is here now, but in 20 years' time it might be up to here, and we could be caught out. So why don't we go ahead of the game? And of course they've got awards from the United Nations Environmental Programme, from the World Wildlife Fund, from everybody. So they've got a lot of good publicity about it, which, yeah, kind of greenwashes the negative stuff they're doing elsewhere. There were also social factors. The population of Perth loves this forest. And, you know, the people working for Alcoa and their executives use the forest for recreation. So they didn't want to see a moonscape there. And they also knew that there was an economic economic, ecological reason, if you like, that this is right in the center of the watershed for Perth. So if they'd had a moonscape and you'd had erosion and siltation, the water supply would have been badly damaged. So there were a whole series of factors. But certainly, I mean, I think it should be a short book in itself, why Alcoa took that decision and why they don't take that kind of decision elsewhere.
Concerning the eucalyptus in South Africa, are there large enough areas that have been cleared of eucalyptus that show that the water function has successfully returned?
Yes, it's still controversial. Because I say, I mean, really to test this scientifically, you'd need to take two very similar catchments and clear from one of them and allow the other one to remain infested. But certainly, the general, you know, and the exterior reviews that have been done of Working for Water, the first one was saying the evidence is very tentative. The second one is saying, actually, yes. There is one figure that's cropping up now that... The clearance program is actually augmenting the water table by the same amount as a medium-sized dam on a major river. So and a lot of farmers are anecdotally saying that streams are running where streams haven't run for 50 years. But in a if you talk to the hydrologists today about the moment when they backed the program, and they're very fine scientists, and they said, look, we thought this was a good idea. We did calculations on the back of an envelope, and it seemed like they would work. They weren't certain. I think the jury is still out, but the decision is looking more, the evidence is looking more positive for that aspect of the program all the time. Other questions as I...
An issue of Science magazine that acknowledged the work in this area most successful or most committed to developing this science.
There are a lot of places that are doing good work now, and I wouldn't want to, I don't feel competent. I don't feel I've looked at the work of enough universities to say one is better than another, but I would happily name a few good ones, the University of Western Australia, for example. There's really good work being done in this state, in DePaul University, Liam Heenahan, and before him Tom Murphy in environmental studies. I've just visited the University of Illinois and looked at restoration projects there and restoration research. University of Northern Iowa, where the whole idea of restoring native plants on roadsides began. Those are just top of the head ones. We're spoiled for choice in a sense. Though what is curious is there are still a lot of departments of environmental studies that do not have restoration courses, and that's disturbing. And there are no restoration courses in my own country, for example, something I'm trying to change. There's some good, very good restoration programs, both corporate funded and non-profit funded, but we don't have strong restoration studies yet. But thank you for the question, because that's given me food for thought for sure. Somebody at the back there, lady?
Consulting with the local people and having respect for that spiritual component of this work.
I think you've touched on, or you haven't just touched on, you've actually identified, I think, a core area, and I don't want to call it a problem, because I actually think, again, it's a kind of a dynamic within the movement, if you like, between science and practice, and also between that local knowledge. And as I say, while I don't think we should romanticize it, it certainly exists. And I think it's very important to include, too, that, you know, people who farmed the land for two or three generations. I'm very struck by a restoration, and I'd really recommend that people look at it, called Burren Life, B-U-R-R-E-N, Life, L-I-F-E, which is a farming for conservation program in Ireland, where it's farmer-led, and the farmers are essentially saying, we now produce biodiversity, but don't tell us how to do it. You know, most farming for conservation programs are based on checklists of things you are not supposed to do on your own land. They kind of say, like, every farm is case specific, and we know what'll work on our land, and it won't necessarily be what works on the neighbor's land. So let us experiment, if you like, and try things out. And they're coming up with remarkable results. And I think that kind of respect for knowledge on the ground is important. I think the relationship, I wouldn't describe it so much as a relationship between engineering and local knowledge as between abstract science and concrete practice, and the two coming together. And yes, the spiritual, aesthetic, however one wants to phrase it, relationship with the land that people have is an important part of the equation also. Somebody who's written very well about this is Robert Cabin, C-A-B-I-N. He's written two books. He is a scientist who, working in Hawaii on restoration programs, became frustrated by the kind of disconnect between his scientific colleagues and land managers in Hawaii, native or colonial, if you like, because he felt that very often the land managers knew the solution to a problem, and the scientists would go off and do experiments for 15 years, and then they'd come back and say, yeah, this is the solution, and the land managers would say, yeah, but I told you that 15 years ago. So he's very good at dealing with this. At the same time, I think it is important that every local or traditional practice is tested and assessed scientifically. So it's a kind of a movement along a spectrum. But I think Robert Cabin has certainly written about it better than anyone I know. Are you thinking that we should be?
Maybe we better.
Can we take one more question over here? We've moved right across. So,
do you have any examples where some conservation governmental agencies or the like have talked with the caretakers of the land and incorporated some of those ideas?
Well, the very best example I know is the one I gave from Mexico. That is one where the Lacandon people have been where they are for quite a long time, though not for a very long time. They've been there for about 200 years because there were a series of displacements of native people through the whole Lacandon area. And I do think that in that case, their knowledge, their practices are being encouraged, they're being subsidized, and they're being taken to their equivalents in other Native American peoples, other Mayan people, in fact, with whom historically they haven't got on particularly well, and they have some difficulties in allowing the export of this technology to the other cultures. But again, there's a kind of restoration of relationships happening there. That's the very best example I know. I know numerous examples where New Zealand, for example, where really excellent restoration is being done within what I would call a Maori cultural envelope. In other words, Maori traditions and ceremonies are attached to the restoration work. But there hasn't been so much of a focus on Maori traditional knowledge. But that's a longer story. I'll talk to you afterwards about it if you like. But that's a good question. Thank you.